This is Lee Habib. This is not Dennis Prager. Dennis has allowed me to sit in on one of his favorite days, July 4th. Thank you for doing that, Dennis, and thank you, Sean, for sitting in. We're lucky today to be joined by Dinesh D'Souza for the entire 3 hours. What you're listening to right now is a remarkable rendition of the Star Spangled Banner by the band Madison Rising. Dinesh had the good sense to bring to the world and to America a really cool new version. Dinesh, welcome to the show, and hey. Congratulations on the movie. Before we even start, folks, Dinesh showed me a text message that he'd gotten from someone called Terry Pooch. And Terry Pooch, that's her handle, had five OMGs, not one, not two, but five OMGs to lead this incredible emotional outpouring about her love of this movie. And she then wrote, "America of Truths, America the Beautiful, made me feel you care about me." Dinesh, congratulations on that on text. Tell me how things are going, how the first few days are going, and just your response to all of it.
Well, Lee, it's such a big weekend for us. The movie just opened on Wednesday, July 2nd. We've had a strong opening Wednesday and then and today. I hope a lot of people go this weekend. It's so important, and the movie is both an intellectual and an emotional experience. It's both. And when you put those two things together, the head and the heart, it's a very powerful combination. You can't do that in a book. You can't do that in a speech. But what I found about a movie is that you can leave 90 minutes later or 95 minutes later, and you're changed from within. You actually see things differently, and you feel differently about America and about yourself. So that's the power of film, and so I'm thrilled to have made a film that I think is in a completely different league, cinematically, emotionally, than 2016.
It sounds like just a very different film emotionally. I mean, I think in the end, in 2016, you were trying to lay down a predicate, an intellectual argument about our president. And not just our president, but the people in the end and the thoughts behind colonialism. You know, you were getting into a world of one man. But in this particular place, you're actually telling a story about a country, I think.
2016 was, in a sense, an easier story. You follow the psychological journey of Obama, and he gives a certain narrative unity, and I'm sort of the observer chasing him down. A film like America, well, America's the protagonist. Well, how do you tell America's story? And, of course, America's the topic of my life. I'm an immigrant. I came to America at the age of 17. All my books, in one way or the other, whether they're about education or civil rights or markets, are converging on the great subject of America. And so I wanted to take this great topic and in a certain sense tell the untold story of America. You mentioned amnesia, the erased story of America that the left has worked so hard over 30 years to frame its own narrative. And it's done for a political purpose. For a long time, I'd refute the left's arguments about this and about that, but I never really knew why they were doing that. In other words, why would people in America want to make America consistently the bad guy?
Right.
What's in it for them?
Yep.
Why do they want to make us feel bad about ourselves? And a part of that's what this movie is about. It's a refutation of the leftist critique of America, but it's also an expose of the motives behind it, the political intrigue that goes into it, and why the culture war, if you will, is not just something the left fights because they believe in it, but ultimately it results in power and money going into their pockets.
Yeah, you know, in the end, in criminal law, we call this the motive. And in order to prosecute, if you don't establish a motive, talk to any prosecutor. Good luck convicting. And I think in essence what you're telling me and you're telling the audience is you are getting at motive here. And by the way, with direct confrontations, and not in a confrontational style, with some of the our true arch enemies intellectually. And that's Noam Chomsky to Michael Eric Dyson, the entire cast of characters right down to Bill Ayers.
For many years, I was struck by the sort of, you could call it the inequity of allegations on both sides. So, for example, when the left talks about us, here's how they talk about us. We are warmongers. We are greedy, selfish, materialistic, racist, anti-woman, homophobic. So they're attacking our motives at the core. We are wicked, bad, rapacious people. Now, when we talk about them, we're like, Well, of course, they're well-meaning and well-intentioned, but right. their policies just don't work very well.
Right, right.
Right? And that can't be right, and it isn't right. So part of what I've been thinking about in my recent work, I have a book, America, Imagine a World Without It, kind of the companion book to the film. In that book, I dig into the leftist motive of envy. Envy. Because envy is a very powerful human motive. In fact, it's more powerful than greed because it's secretive. Greed is kind of out in the open. Envy, on the other hand, is something you deny not only to others but even to yourself.
No, it's furtive. It's really furtive.
And envy is often confused with jealousy. Now, jealousy is actually kind of noble because in jealousy, you're angry about being deprived of something that's yours. Othello is jealous that his wife Desdemona, he thinks, is having an affair.
Right.
But he has a right to be angry if she is. She isn't, but if she were, he would have a right to be indignant. Iago is envious, and envy is coveting something that's not yours. So the key to understanding the left is the smoldering emotion of coveting things that are not theirs, that they want to seize by force. And it's these motives of envy, resentment, hatred, and self-hatred that actually drive the left, but we don't see it because it's covered with the passport of morality.
You bet. And words like justice.
Well, that's why Obama keeps chanting fair share, fair share. The left is very shrewd about seizing the high ground of justice, which, go back to Aristotle, is the primary political emotion. Not freedom, justice. I say in the film that justice can trump liberty. When we see something unjust, our blood boils. And what we have done, unfortunately, is ceded the high ground of justice. So when we play the king, liberty, they can play the ace, justice, and they'll win every time.
You bet. Hold that thought. We're here with Dinesh D'Souza for the full 3 hours. Lee Habib sitting in for Dennis Prager. America, Imagine the World Without Her. Go to the website, sign up, go to a theater. What a way to celebrate the 4th. Lee Habib again, sitting in for Dennis Prager.
Muriel plays piano every Friday at the Hollywood. And they brought me down to see her, and they asked me if I would do a little number, and I sang with all my might. She said, "Tell me, are you a Christian child?" And I said, "Ma'am, I am." Tonight, walking in Memphis, was walking with my feet 10 feet.
This is Lee Habib sitting in for Dennis Prager. You're listening to one of the great lyrics in the history of music. Mark Cohen, a Jewish songwriter, travels down as a narrator down to Memphis to sing at this little place called the Hollywood, a legendary blues bar, where a large African-American woman in her mid-60s invites him up to sing. And to sing with all his might, she asks him, "Son, are you a Christian?" And he says, "This Jewish man, ma'am, I am tonight." That's America, folks. A Jew in a pilgrimage to the home of Elvis to sing gospel and blues. Back here with Dinesh D'Souza, and I wanted to talk a little bit of digression from the movie to the heart of it all, and I think why Dinesh has been obsessed with all of this, his life. I've known Dinesh since, well, Dinesh, I hate to admit it, 1988 we met at the University of Virginia Law School. And then you were working on a little book called Illiberal Education. And it was marvelous and was just getting at the things you're still getting at today. You came to this country from India at the age of, well, that ripe age of the teenage years, where most of us are just, you know, graduating from high school and working on our SATs and, you know, thinking how to plod along. But you do something radical. You leave everything you know, like my grandparents did, and you came here. Talk a little about that, Dinesh.
Well, I came almost by chance. I was in the 11th grade in high school. In Mumbai, Bombay, India, and a fellow from the Bombay Rotary Club came and spoke at our school, and he said, "We've got this exchange program in which we send students to different countries, Australia, England, but also America, and we're inviting students who might want to do that for the 12th grade. It's an interesting experience, and you see a different part of the world." My only exposure to America at that point had been essentially Western movies, and war movies left over from the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And but I just remember, I applied for the program, and I did it, and I Remember my first sensation when I saw America for the first time? This was the airplane landing at JFK, and I just looked out the window. I could see the skyscrapers of Manhattan. I saw the Statue of Liberty. I just somehow intuitively realized that my life would be completely different from that moment on. In fact, subsequently, now when I read The Great Gatsby, in the last page or the second to the last page, he talks about the astonishment of the Dutch sailors as they came around the bend and they saw what he calls the green breast of the New World. That sense of hope and possibility and life suddenly opening up horizons. That's the way the Dutch sailors felt. That's the way I felt. And that feeling has never left me. That actually is the driving emotional force of all my work. So in that sense, I feel America in relationship to the rest of the world. And this film is intended to capture not only my thoughts about America, but also that very primordial feeling about America.
You know, the other day I was talking to my dad, and my dad was a history teacher, ended up being a superintendent of schools and my hero. And he said, you know, I've got a little something for you. You should read to Dinesh. And it's the naturalization oath of allegiance to the United States of America. And by the way, my dad had urged me to go to some of the swearing-in ceremonies, one in particular in Jersey City. And I would go on July 4th to Jersey City and listen to anywhere from 1,000 to 1,200 people at a time swear in. One of the most beautiful things an American can do is go to one of these swearing-in ceremonies, because the stories are, in the end, almost all the same, even though the people are from all around the world. And here's the oath, Dinesh, and just wondering what your thoughts are as I read it to you, your memory of it. Now, this is the oath, folks, and I think, wouldn't it be nice if all Americans had to take this oath at a certain point, maybe before they vote or something? The oath goes like this. I hereby declare on oath that I absolutely and entirely renounce and abjure all allegiance and fidelity to any foreign prince, potentate, state, or sovereignty, of whom or which I have heretofore been a subject or citizen, that I will support and defend the Constitution and the laws of the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that I will bear arms on behalf of the United States when required by the law, that I will perform noncombatant service in the armed forces of the United States when required by that law, that I will perform work of national importance under civilian direction when required by that law, and that I take this obligation freely without any mental reservations or purpose of evasion. So help me, God. What does that bring back for you, Dinesh?
Well, my first...
Those are serious words, by the way. Those are really serious words.
My first thought upon listening to it is, I wonder if Obama in good conscience could take that oath.
Anyway,
we won't go down that road. He's lucky to be born in the United States. In my case, I remember it was a rainy day in September in Washington, D.C., when I went to the courthouse with a whole bunch of other people. And there's an interview that precedes the oath. And for me, it was slightly comical because the guy said things like, so let me see right here. You went to Dartmouth College and, you know, you worked at the White House and you worked in the American Enterprise Institute. And then he goes, you know, do you write and speak English? I didn't even know what to say. But it, nevertheless, the oath very moving for me because it's a transfer of allegiance. And I, of course, I did it with full recognition that I was consciously embracing this. And I had just come out of, you know, an academic culture where they keep drumming into your head, all cultures are created equal.
Right.
Right? And I'm thinking to myself, if all cultures are created equal, no one would ever emigrate.
Right.
Why would you leave what's already natural to you, your family, your friends, the world you know, and go into the unknown if you didn't think that this new culture, this new world was for you decisively better? So the immigrant is voting with his or her feet in the most decisive way possible against his or her own culture and in favor of a new culture.
Indeed. And you left behind a lot. I mean, I'm going to get into the story of Frank Capra in the next segment. In each of the hours, I'm going to be telling a great Italian immigrant story. My mom recently passed of Italian heritage. Her father took the great risk of all risks and moved his entire family here, not speaking the language. Told me often about how painful and hard that was, and that he was doing it in the end for the next generation. He was doing it for her. He was doing it for my mom. I don't know if I'd be capable of moving to California right now. and I'm living in Memphis. And so the courage that it took, Dinesh, talk just a little touch. We're coming up against a hard break. But some of the pain that you had to experience going through something like that.
The whole immigrant experience is, in a way, it extracts a heavy cost. I mean, I remember as I walked off the airport heading to the plane, I looked back. My sister was crying. My mom said nothing. She was just smiling. And later she said to me, I didn't want you to feel like we were – she wanted me to feel good about going, you know. But as I look back, I mean, my dad died in the year 2000. I mean, I at 17 was, in a sense, severing my relationship with my family. I would subsequently only visit them usually for a week or two at a time. And so I missed out on that whole phase of life. But I would still do it again. Not because America has offered me – prosperity. I was in a middle class family in India. My dad was a chemical engineer, so I had a good life, and I didn't lack for anything.
Right.
But America has offered me a chance to be the architect of my own destiny, do things with my life that would not be possible, and even my family would be thrilled for me to do that rather than for me to stay home.
You bet. And when we get back, we'll hear about Frank Capra, one of the great and legendary American directors. Some clips from him. And we'll want to hear from you, 877-243-7776. Lee Habib sitting in for Dennis Prager.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
This is Lee Habib sitting in for Dennis Prager here on July 4th. Dinesh D'Souza in the studio for all 3 hours. Folks, no better way to celebrate July 4th. Take your family, take friends, take a liberal to see America. Imagine the world without her. It'll change them, I think. They'll hear and see things they've never seen before. Heck, they'll learn a little about Frederick Douglass. That alone's worth the price of admission. We'll be talking about Frederick Douglass to Tocqueville in the next hour. Right now, I want to talk to you a little about Frank Capra. We're going to be talking about one immigrant story in each hour, and Capra's is a remarkable one. Few filmmakers have impacted a culture like he did. Few had more humble beginnings. Born in Sicily, he emigrated to the United States in 1903 with his parents. By the way, his father picked grapes. After a short stint in college, studying engineering, he served in the U.S. Army during World War I, then began an unlikely journey into the film business. He started as a grip, got to know some writers, started hanging around in cafes, and got this crazy idea that maybe he could be a script writer. And pretty soon, it started happening for him. It happened one night, was his first big break, an Oscar. More Oscars to come in 1936, Mr. Deed Goes to Town. 1938, another for You Can't Take It With You. Three Oscars. Then something strange happens. He decides, along with Stevens and Ford, three great American filmmakers, to drop their careers, fly in planes over World War II battlefields, risk their lives, and film World War II propaganda films for America. Why We Fight was the series he did, seven parts. It changed the country, and his proudest honor, as he would say many times over, is winning the Medal of Honor on the art side from the President of the United States. Well, Frank Capra was at the American Film Institute in 1981, and he was getting a Lifetime Achievement Award. And he decided, rather than talk about the movie business, that he'd talk about the country he loved, the country that adopted his father, an immigrant who did not speak English, but allowed the next generation to accomplish, well, remarkable things. And so here is Capra. Every celebrity's there, and he's telling this story about the country, telling the story about when he came over on this ship. Sean, fire two.
Nearly 79 years ago, I celebrated my 6th birthday in the black, dark hole of a creaking ship crammed with retching, praying, terrorized immigrants. 13 days of misery. And then the ship stopped. And my father grabbed me and carried me up the steep iron stairs to the deck. And then he shouted, "Chico, look at that." At first, all I saw was a deck full of people on their knees, crying and rejoicing. My father cried, "That's the greatest light since the Star of Bethlehem." I looked up, and there was the statue of a great lady, taller than a church steeple, holding a lamp over the land we were about to enter. And my father said, "It's the light of freedom, Chico. Remember that. Freedom."
Capra continued, and by now there wasn't a dry eye in the house. In fact, if you go on the AFI's website, you'll see Bob Hope crying, and he's sitting next to Betty Davis, and she's crying. Here's how Capra completed things. He was pointing up to the sky. You couldn't see it. He was talking to all of his dead relatives. Go ahead, Sean.
So, finally, there is something I must say to some other members of my family, and I believe that they will hear me. Mama, Papa, Big Brother Ben, Josephine, Tony, Little Sister Anne, remember the day we arrived at the Southern Pacific Station here in Los Angeles, and Papa and Mama kissed the ground? Look, the American Film Institute has given me its Life Achievement Award. And for that, I am thanking them and all my friends who have come here. But for America, just for living here, I kiss the ground. Thank you very much.
Not a bad speech. Not a bad speech. My grandfather came to this country barely speaking English and gave me this great bounty. My family, my sister's joining me, my dad's listening. Dinesh has experienced this great bounty. When we come back, more from Dinesh D'Souza and some from you. 877-243-7776. Lee Habib sitting in for Dennis Prager. America, imagine the world without her. Go see it. Bring a family. Heck, bring a liberal.
With a name their kids Billy, turn on the radio and hear my man Willie. Friday night football, stand up and cheer. Go where I want to go, I'm a free man here.
This is Lee Habib sitting in for Dennis Prager, joined by Dinesh D'Souza for the 3 hours today here on July 4th. Thank you for Dennis. Thank you, Dennis, for letting me sit in. Thanks, Sean, for coming in on a day off. Dinesh, we just heard from Frank Capra about the immigrant experience. I want to get back into that idea that we had touched on just in the beginning of the show about the nation being built on theft and the left's narrative of this country, the 1% stealing the inheritance from our Indians, from the people who were here before we were here. Talk about that.
The virtues of America, I think, arise from the peculiar character of the immigrant experience. The immigrants are restless people. They often come with nothing, no connections. So they have to build from the ground. And the idea of wealth creation comes out of that. The virtues of frugality, hard work, deferred gratification, these are immigrant virtues. And I think they're what set the American people apart. Now, here's the key point. When the left attacks, makes its attack, it pretends like it's attacking the 1%, the rich. But if you really think about it, the rich people were sitting in their mansions or cottages on the East Coast. Who are the people who went out west? Who are the people who defeated the Indians and took the land? Who are the people who won the Mexican War? This wasn't the 1%. This was poor, penniless immigrants and settlers who did that. Who benefited from slavery? Everyone who could buy a cotton dress or a cotton shirt. So here's the point I want to make. The leftist attack is on the immigrants. And the leftist attack is on immigrant virtues of hard work, deferred gratification, what we call Yankee ingenuity, innovation, enterprise, that deep faith that sustains you in moments of cosmic loneliness. This is what the left hates, but it can't speak it. It can't say that. And therefore, it pretends like it's going after some rich guy in a frock coat. That's not who its real target is.
You bet. The 1% were not lured by the Homestead Act. to drop everything and go and work on arid deserts and ultimately turn it into something.
Look at the Mexican War. What happened was Texas was part of Mexico. And the Mexicans wanted to have Anglos settle in that land. And so they got all kinds of inducements, and all kinds of dirt poor people went to Texas and settled there. Not just whites, but Hispanics as well. And when the dictator Santa Anna began to tyrannize over the Texans says, forget it, we're not going to live under this. And it was a coalition of whites and Mexicans who banded together and broke with Mexico. So in other words, for Mexican Americans, there's a heroic story about how their ancestors fought the Mexican War on the American side, if you will. In other words, for Texas independence and then for Texas to be part of the United States. But the left has completely erased that story. Why? Because they want to make it seem like it was the wicked United States grabbing half of Mexico in an act of piracy. So this is a perfect example of the sort of sly doctoring of history that has now insinuated its way into not only our college textbooks, but in the elementary and secondary schools. It's part of a rigged narrative of American shame that is the target of our movie America.
Yeah, and ultimately, I think to promote Dinesh in the end, not only self-doubt, but I think something more virulent, which is self-hate.
Yeah, this brings us right back to the issue of envy that I mentioned earlier. And I think that is the core of understanding what motivates a guy like Obama. See, I think America is an entrepreneurial society with entrepreneurial virtues. A guy like Steve Jobs, think about that. He creates something that we didn't even know we wanted or needed until he presented it. It's a perfect example of the kind of ingenuity. Now, did Steve Jobs rip off anybody? No. We all willingly stand in line to buy our iPhones. Now, look at Obama. Obama couldn't possibly create the iPhone. I mean, that guy can't even put up a website.
Right.
But that doesn't mean he's untalented. He has talents. His talents are things like working up the mob, stirring up resentment. And he's full of resentment. So he can create the – he's a resentment organizer. And what he's able to say to resentful people is, listen, you're not being resentful. You're actually being indignant because Steve Jobs and other entrepreneurs are stealing from you. So all you have to do is vote for me. I will go and take their stuff, and I will give some of it to you. So this is the sort of envious, covetous transaction that is masquerading as social justice. But unless it is met on its own ground and refuted, it continues to travel. It continues to gain political traction.
And met on the ground of justice, too. You've got to meet justice with justice.
That's right. You can't change the subject. You can't say, yes, we took the country from the Indians,
but right.
And that has been the conservative narrative for 30 years.
Right.
But we also did some good things. Hey, we won World War II. No. Let's go back and look at this original theft. Let's look at the actual choices available to the American founders. People say, well, slavery was our original sin. Wait a minute. You have to – were the founders actually in a position to get rid of slavery? What would be the consequence had they declared at the outset, we're going to have a union – without slavery, how many states would have joined such a union?
There would have been no union.
So that's the point, that you cannot fault people for not making, for not exercising options that were not available to them at the time.
Exactly. And by the way, the institution of slavery around the world at the time, how did people live around the world contextually? A story not told in our history departments or in our schools either. Tonight.
This is why this film is exploding and causing people – it's blowing people's minds. This is also, by the way, why the left has come out so strongly against it. With the last film, 2016, there was a deadly silence. And it was only when the Pied Piper Obama on his website, BarackObama.com, came out raving and ranting against the film that all the other minions fell into line. But with the new film, they're out the gate screaming and yelling, and horrible film, racist film, don't see this film. They don't want people to see this film because they're scared that if people who are in the middle, who haven't made up their mind, or young people see this film, it's kind of like they suddenly get this creeping feeling that a lot of stuff that they've been taught is a lie.
You bet.
It's a very liberating experience.
Although, no, there's no doubt. Lee Habib, I'm in here for 3 hours with Dinesh D'Souza today, the whole day. Again, take your family, if you can, to America. Imagine the world without her. Take friends. Go once, go twice, and again, heck, bring a liberal, bring two, bring a bunch. Pay for them, by the way. You'll have to pay for them, but they're used to that. We'll be back with Dinesh after this short break.
history that needs to be portrayed, needs to be made clear to a student or to a reader, is that nothing ever had to happen the way it happened. Nothing ever had to happen the way it happened. History could have gone off at any number of different directions in any number of different ways at any point all the way along the line, just as your own life can. Nor, in a way, was there ever anything like the past. There was never any past, if you stop to think about it. Nobody lived in the past. Jefferson, Adams, Washington, they didn't walk around saying, "Isn't this fascinating, living in the past? Aren't we picturesque in our funny clothes?" They lived in the present, just as we do. The difference was it was their present, not ours. And just as we don't know how things are going to turn out for us, they didn't either.
This is Lee Habib sitting in for Dennis Prager, joined by Dinesh D'Souza for the entire 3 hours. That was the great David McCulloch talking at Hillsdale College, a great sponsor of this show. One of the great talks I've ever heard about history. The past was never the past. Dinesh, this gets to your point about the choices those founders had to make. Even as slavery is taught today, the Constitution set up the mechanism by which slavery could end.
Well, when I think about McCulloch, those wise words, people who lived in the Renaissance didn't know they were living in the Renaissance. People who lived in the Middle Ages didn't know they were living in the Middle Ages. Those are our categorizations. We've divided history into those periods, and we've plunked them into that. This is important because I think with the left you get this notion of progressive history. And progressive history is a way of demeaning the past because it's a way of saying, listen, we had those guys, Washington, Jefferson and company, and they were pretty smart, but they botched up a lot of things. And things have been getting better ever since. And right now we've kind of got Obama and Hillary, far wiser than the founders, who can kind of perfect or finish the job, remake America in Obama's words. And you only have to set these people side by side to realize how absurdly comical this is. What deep arrogance goes into the assumptions that build on this notion of progress. The truth of the matter is, and this is part of why I think our film is interesting, we drop people into time so that they can see that these big debates, were the founders hypocritical, were recognized by the founders, were debated between Abraham Lincoln and Stephen Douglas at the Lincoln-Douglas debates. So suddenly you realize that your own undergraduate speculations about this are not original. Much wiser people have thought more deeply about these topics before.
Lee Habib with Dinesh D'Souza. America, imagine the world without her. Take your family, take your friends. This is Lee Habib sitting in for Dennis Prager.
See, we got a little
joined by Dinesh D'Souza. There. Filmmaker, writer, and his latest is America, Imagine the World Without Her. And what a better way to celebrate the 4th than to bring your family. Go to the website, sign up, find out where the theater is playing around you. If it's not, demand the movie. Demand the movie. Dinesh has gotten great distribution on this film. I want to go and lead with, I'm going to set this up, a trailer from the film that Dinesh had done a great job of bringing some of the great critics of America together. Dinesh has this talent. He can actually sit down with folks on the other side, and rather than attack them and rather than ridicule them, he simply has a conversation with them. We don't do this enough with people we disagree with. And they've actually, in this film, you actually get to see these conversations. Bill Ayers from the Weather Underground, Michael Eric Dyson, University of Pennsylvania, a race theorist, I would almost call him at this point, and Noam Chomsky, among others, that Dinesh sat down with. And so let's hear a bit from this trailer, if we could.
We're living in the American era, but this moment of American triumph is very fragile.
Of course we can say thievery was a critical element to the expansion of American empire and the establishment of the American way of life. Of course.
The settlers came in, drove out, exterminated the native population. That's one of the two original sins of society.
Another being slavery?
The other is slavery.
The ideal of racial reparations is a good one. I think it's one about justice.
want to blow up Mount Rushmore. You're quoted saying it's like having Hitler looking over you.
It's a symbol of oppression. It's a symbol of genocide for our people.
Well, there's a reason why most of the world regards the United States as a predatory colonial power.
The war with Germany has ended. The forces of freedom have triumphed.
One small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
When you hear the name America, what are some words that come to your mind?
European expansion, conquest, colonization, genocide.
Private capital, unless it's constrained in some fashion, is extremely destructive.
And more destructive than even centralized federal power?
In a country like ours, yes, much more destructive.
This argument at the core is a moral indictment of America and of the free market system.
Reagan had called the Soviet Union, you remember, an evil empire, and the Soviet Union.
This is Lee Habib.
So who's the new evil empire?
Some of the voices you were hearing towards the end. One, Ward Churchill, by the way, and talking about theft and conquest and colonialism. Can you imagine a date with Ward Churchill? Could you imagine how upbeat that afternoon might be or evening? I mean, I'd be not only ordering a check quick, but the Xanax and possibly even a pistol to blow my brains out. Dinesh, you sat down with so many of these guys. First of all, why did they give you the interview? They know who you are. Why did they do that?
Because I convinced them that I wasn't going to do the Michael Moore thing with them. In other words, if you look at the way that Michael Moore treats his critics, what he does is he ambushes them. He shows up at Charlton Heston's house and grab him in his sleep and so on. His idea is not to let you, to make you look stupid before you even open your mouth.
Right.
And I convinced these guys I was not going to do that. I actually wanted to hear what they had to say. I told them, listen, if you make a mistake, say it again. And what I wanted to do is explore the workings of their mind. And so when Ward Churchill began to talk about America being the evil empire, the way I approach it is not to attack him and say, you're wrong, you're a fool, but to say rather, okay, well, if America really is the evil empire, then according to you, we're sort of living like in Nazi Germany. Now, if I was living in Nazi Germany, I would try to do everything I could to destroy that regime. I would try to prevent it from being a menace to the world and a menace to its own citizens. So if you had an atomic bomb, would you drop it on America? And that's the, then you can, it's a very fascinating moment in the film. You can see the little tumblers of his mind working as he thinks through the implications of his own premises.
You bet.
So it helps us to realize that with the left, they say promiscuously certain things about America. We're the bad guy, we're evil, etc. And then certain consequences follow. So if Obama thinks that America is the bad guy, if he thinks we're arrogant, we're imperialistic, we're the bully of the world, by the way, he said all those things in one verse, then it should not be surprising that he sees his mission as one of curtailing America.
You bet.
He sees his mission as shrinking the American dream, undermining America. In foreign policy, I think what he wants to do is make us, in a sense, another Canada. And what I mean by that is that when things happen around the world, the Canadians have a point of view, but we don't know and we don't care, and neither does anyone else. Why? Because Canada is a normal country.
Right.
America has had such an outsized influence, we take it for granted since World War II, that nothing can really happen in the world without us at least having a say-so, if not determining the outcome. And if Obama has his way, that will end.
Well, you did the same thing in 2016 in the end, Dinesh. You had respect for the argument that Barack Obama was making. And I mean respect, you heard it out, and then you listened to it, and you counted it on its own merits, and not through arguments ad hominem or attacks, which regrettably has been too much of what we've done on our side. You know, Buckley, back when he did Firing Line, those were remarkable conversations he was having with his ideological enemies. And regrettably, and I'm almost going to sound like one of those, you know, we're not in red state, blue state, purple state, there aren't venues where we can actually sit down and have these conversations. If there were, we would wipe the floor with them. The rubric right now of MSNBC and Fox News actually does us a disservice, because if you get us in the room together, we'll win. But we never actually get to sit down like you did there. And I think this is one of the great features, folks, of this film, is to see many of these professors not mocked, not ridiculed, but actually taken seriously. And their arguments met head on by Dinesh D'Souza, not with argument, but almost roping them along to the logical consequence of their premise.
This is why I think the left is running scared on this, because ironically, the way to hit hard is to approach things gently.
You bet.
It's more of a jujitsu. You don't come out screaming and yelling. You let the other side throw its punches, and you wait. You don't. There are long parts in the film, and the left sometimes mocks me for this, where you see me and I'm literally saying nothing.
Right.
You see me two or three times in a debate in the movie, and the other guy is always speaking. I'm only standing there. So why? Because that's not my place to fight back.
Right.
That's my place to hear him out and let him do his thing, and then I can step back and say, all right. Now let's see if this makes sense. You know, what really was going on with the Native American tribes when the Europeans got here? That's a question people don't know. We took the country from the Native Americans. Well, what were they doing with each other before that? So there's a time and a place to go into that. One of the things I'm proudest about with this film is in 2016 we traveled through space, Hawaii, Indonesia, Kenya. In this film we traveled through time. So when we're discussing a question, boom, there we are in the Lincoln-Douglas debates. And Frederick Douglass, what a character. By the way, probably the greatest African-American in our nation's history.
You bet.
And yet one that has been really downplayed, if not virtually erased by the left. And there's a very good reason for it. Frederick Douglass was not only a Republican, but if we were to listen to some of the things he were to say today, it would sound like he was a founder of the Tea Party.
You know, it's interesting when you on Booker T. Washington's birthday, I had pulled up some of the sound from the Atlanta Exposition in 1914, and this is one of the great debates in American history. You've got Du Bois, the Marxist, black, the talented 10th is his theory, sent them all to Harvard, and it'll all trickle down to the ex-slaves. And you had Booker T. Washington saying, cast down your buckets here, let's get jobs, let's start businesses. It's a self-help mechanism. And Booker T. Washington, of course, is written off in history as an Uncle Tom and a sellout. And Du Bois, who dies, what, in Africa, Dinesh, or something like that?
Du Bois renounced his American citizenship. He became an admirer of Stalin. I think at the age of 90, he moved to Ghana, where he ultimately died as a citizen of Ghana.
Right.
So, yes, this kind of bitterness against America leads to the renunciation of America. And as you'll see from our film, and you see from Bill Ayers, it leads, in some cases, to not only wishing, but acting to destroy America.
You bet. Lee Habib here, sitting with Dinesh D'Souza, 877-243-7776. I want to hear from you if you've seen the film. I also want to hear from you about any story, about an immigrant story particularly. I'm going to be spending some time each hour talking about immigrant stories, particularly Italian-American immigrants. My mom, who passed last year, her father came to this country and her mother, barely speaking the language, and just doing something marvelous for all of us, and that is giving us life here in this great country. I'm going to be telling you a story about Mario Andretti. It's a remarkable story. The Wall Street Journal covered it about 6 months ago, and I'll be hitting that later. But when we come back from the break, I want to hear from you. We're going to talk about de Tocqueville. We're also going to talk about Frederick Douglass in more detail. Lee Habib again, sitting in here for Dennis Prager. Again, America, imagine the world without her. Bring a friend, bring two, and if you can afford it, bring a few liberals too.
What I'm saying to you this morning, my friend, even if it falls your lot to be a street sweeper, go on out and sweep streets like Michelangelo painted pictures. Sweep streets like Handel and Beethoven composed music. Sweep streets like Shakespeare wrote portraits. Sweep streets so well that all the hosts of heaven and earth will have to pause and say, here lived a great street sweeper who swept his job well. If you can't be a pine on the top of a hill, be a scrub in the valley, but be the best little scrub on the side of the rill. Be a bush if you can't be a tree. If you can't be a highway, just be a trail. If you can't be the sun, be a star. It isn't by size that you win or you fail. Be the best of whatever you are. And when you do this, you've mastered the length of life.
This is Lee Habib, son of a preacher man, and one of the great preacher men, Martin Luther King, talking about the efficacy of work, implored by the Bible itself. And again, an American product, Martin Luther King. And our freedoms allowed the great civil rights movement to occur and happen. If Martin Luther King had been in India, Salman Rushdie had talked about this at one point, and he had tried to do what he had done, he would have succeeded as Gandhi did, because India had been, well, the British respected civil disobedience. Try doing that with Stalin. Try doing that in North Korea. Try using rhetoric and speech and the tools of civil disobedience to win in any other country in the world. Dinesh, some comments just on that remarkable street sweeper speech by MLK.
Well, I think there's a whole side to Martin Luther King that is ignored. At one point, Martin Luther King said, "Every man must write with his own hand the charter of his Emancipation Proclamation." And what he was saying is that in a country, we want equal rights, and we should fight for those. But ultimately, what we make of our rights and what we do with our lives, that's up to us. Other point I want to make about King is that King's argument, remember King's famous speech, "I'm submitting a promissory note. I'm demanding that it be cashed. It's a debt to which every American falls heir." Well, who wrote that promissory note? Right? Was it the segregationists? Did the Southerners promise them something and then renege? No. It was, ironically, Thomas Jefferson. Right? It was a Virginia planter who wrote, "All men are created equal." And that's the note that King was trying to cash. So here's my point. All progress in America is a return to the founding. It's not a break with the founding, and all these leftists who are contemptuous of the founding don't realize that they're parasitic on the founding, and their greatest achievements, if you will, have been nothing more than a realization of the principles of 1776.
You bet. The old is new, and the progressives want to just get rid of the old.
And that's what we as conservatives are conserving. What are we conserving? The spirit of the American Revolution.
Right. No doubt. It was with Dinesh D'Souza all 3 hours. America, imagine the world without her. It's the subject, by the way, tonight of Megyn Kelly's full show. Dinesh will be on with the final part of his debate with Bill Ayers, and hopefully we'll get to see a lot more of that. Dinesh had a debate with him at Dartmouth. You can see that at his website. And again, bring your family, bring friends. What better way to celebrate the 4th of July than to learn a little bit about your country and also to learn a lot more about our country's critics. And again, learning how to talk to those critics, I think, is crucial. I think no one talks to our critics better than Dinesh does. And I think, Dinesh, what you also do is meet them on the moral level. You tell a story. I think, I'm not sure the university you told it at, but it had to do with sandwiches and social justice. And if you could share that really briefly, and then we're going to be getting into Frederick Douglass and Tocqueville in a bit.
Well, I'll say a word first, if I may, about the about learning about your country. Because normally, as Americans, we don't need to learn about our country. In the same way that if we're living in a house, we don't need to know the blueprints that built our house. We just walk around, sit on the couch, and so on. But it's only when your house begins to shake, then you suddenly say, "Let me go in the attic. Let me figure out how this was put together." So we're in that stage of America's history where we're facing the fragility of the American experiment and the American dream. That's why it's really important for ordinary citizens to know a little bit, or more than a little bit, about the blueprints that helped put this great experiment together.
You bet.
Now, with regard to the debate, yes, I was debating Michael Shermer. We were actually at, I think, the University of Oregon. Mm-hmm. And somebody said something like, "Well, Dinesh, you call yourself a Christian, but how can you be critical of Obamacare? Isn't Obamacare a form of charity, of doing, you know, good and helping other people?" And I was making the point that actually the government strips virtue out of every transaction. And I gave an example. I said, listen. I said to Michael, I said, "Well, Shermer, imagine if you and I are walking on the riverbank and I have a sandwich and you say, 'I'm hungry, give me half your sandwich.' And I go, 'Okay, here you go.' I say, 'That's a good thing because I feel that I've done a good deed, and I have. You feel a sense of gratitude. Maybe one day if you can help somebody else, you will.' So it's a virtuous transaction all the way around. But now imagine exactly the same situation. We're walking on the riverbank. You ask for a sandwich. For whatever reason, I say no. Then what happens? Let's say that Obama comes around on a white horse. He dismounts. He comes up to me, puts a gun to my head. He says, 'Dinesh, turn over half your sandwich.' And so I do. And he turns it over to Shermer. Now, the outcome is the same. Shermer has half a sandwich and I do, just as in the first case. But all the virtue has been stripped out of this transaction. Why? Because I didn't give voluntarily. I don't deserve any moral credit. I was forced to give.
Right.
The guy who gets the sandwich isn't grateful. He feels entitled. He's why am I getting half a sandwich? Where's the rest of it for me?
Right.
So what you've done is even though the result is the same, you have polluted the transaction and you have taken away any tincture of goodness about it.
Yeah, you've stripped in the end the virtue and you've corrupted the process.
And that's why when liberalism presents itself as a kind of expanded form of Christian charity, Christians should see right through it and recognize that there's no virtue in this transaction.
No doubt. And that's almost the subject of an entire other 3-hour show, the social justice wing of the evangelical movement and actually the Catholic Church as well. I'm with Dinesh D'Souza again, America, Imagine the World Without Her. And in the coming segments, we're going to be talking about Frederick Douglass and de Tocqueville. Dinesh, a few friends have seen the film, and they said Tocqueville was quite a nappy dresser. this Frenchman comes to the United States to study our penal system, and something else happens. We've got just about 30 seconds here, but set us up so when we come in out of the break, we're hitting the ground running on Tocqueville.
Well, the importance of Tocqueville, of course, he was a French aristocrat, and he came to America in 1831, traveled through several states, saw slavery, saw the American life. Now, the founding had been 50 years earlier, and the beauty of Tocqueville is he came at a time when he could see the founding principles as they were, not just argued about in Philadelphia or written down on a piece of paper, but as they had imprinted themselves on the souls of everyday Americans. And, you know, when Obama sits around and goes, well, we're not exceptional because the Brits think they're exceptional and the Greeks, blah, 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 blah. Tocqueville, no foreigner agrees with Obama. All the way back from Tocqueville to me, we come from other countries and we're constantly noticing things about America that would never occur anywhere else. And it catches our attention. And Tocqueville is a great observer of the uniqueness of America.
When we come back, more on de Tocqueville, Frederick Douglass, and oddly enough, Mario Andretti. Lee Habib sitting in for Dennis Prager. America, Imagine the World Without Her. Go to the website. Sign up. If the movie isn't in your area, demand the movie. America, Imagine the World Without Her. See it. Bring a friend. Bring two. And if you can, bring some liberals too.
Picked up my bags and went looking for a place to hide. When I saw old Carmen and the devil walking side by side, and I said, hey Carmen, come on, let's go downtown. She said, I gotta go, but my friend can stick around. Take a load off, Fanny. Take a load for free.
Portions of the Dennis Prager Show are sponsored in part by the new film, America, Imagine the World Without Her.
Lee Habib, sitting in for Dennis Prager. Dinesh D'Souza joins me for the entire show. You're listening to Mavis and Pop Staples with the band, Martin Scorsese directing. Just American music in its purest form. Gospel meeting rock, meeting roots, meeting Appalachia. All coming together, white and black and every other ethnic creed in one beautiful, beautifully captured moment, again by Martin Scorsese, The Last Waltz, one of the great musical movies ever recorded. Dinesh, I wanted to talk a bit about de Tocqueville and what his observations were, and this sort of trinity, these three things that he saw as distinguishing America from any place he'd ever seen in his life.
I think the first thing he saw was the spirit of entrepreneurship, and he was struck by how innovative Americans were and how they fixed their own problems. Americans were sort of improvisers and fixers. And, of course, most entrepreneurship is not a Steve Jobs. It's not coming up with something, if you will, taking sand and making it into silicon. It's improving things. It's like looking at a suitcase and going, wouldn't it be nice to have some wheels on that so we don't have to lug it around by lifting 50 pounds? We can actually roll it. What a brilliant invention, and it's remarkable that it was only thought of like 10 years ago.
Right.
And before that, everybody lugged heavy suitcases through the airport. So the Americans are constantly thinking of ways. A guy sitting in a car, he wants to have a cup of coffee. But the place for the coffee holder should be exactly where his hand naturally falls. And so this is how Americans think this way. In other countries, people just think what can't be done. But so Tocqueville noticed that restless, creative, problem-solving American spirit. A second thing he noticed was the religiosity of America. And he makes a striking comment. Christianity, he says, is the first of their political institutions. So he's not talking about the fact that people are religious kind of in private or at home. He's saying that that is what informs their public life. That's what brings them together into communities, groups, and the temperance movement, and also the politics. So he'd apparently never heard of the wall of separation between church and state.
Right.
And even Jefferson meant something quite different when he said that to the Danbury.
You bet.
So what's going on here is, again, this is progressive history. It's kind of doctoring the past to suit a present-day political objective. And Tocqueville has become persona non grata because he was the apostle of American exceptionalism. He's talked about Americans as being, and I think this is an exact quote, a unique species of mankind. He realized that the founders were not just designing a government, they were designing almost a new way to be human.
You bet.
And today, you know, for me, it's very hopeful. It's hopeful and depressing. It's hopeful to see this American formula being adopted all around the world,
right.
In China, in India, and yet we seem to have forgotten some of that magic here at home, and it's partly due to this not just Obama, not just Hillary, but this vast progressive movement that is beyond politics. It's in the schools, it's in Hollywood, it's in the media, and this drumbeat of anti-Americanism today is not coming from abroad. It's coming from right at home.
Oh, you bet. And the third thing was, I think, that you skipped was the associations. That everywhere he went, he saw Americans forming these groups to solve a particular problem, and every kind of organization that could be imagined. By the way, my favorite, Laura and I, back when we did the show together, every year we would visit the Elvis Presley Impersonators Association. This was like 13,000 human beings going to Las Vegas, and they make some kind of at least a little bit of a living, and that's an association.
Well,
and we love that part of America.
I remember my mom visiting many years ago. We're driving on the highway, and we saw this sign that just says, "Adopt a Highway." And my mom sort of caught her attention. She's like, "What does he mean by it? What do you mean by adopt a highway? Who adopts a highway?" I said, "Well, you know, it's like the Rotary, the Kiwanis Club. Some organization agrees to take the responsibility for cleaning the highway, picking up trash." And my mom, it wasn't that she didn't disagree. She just couldn't even comprehend why anyone would even think like that. So here's another example. This is American exceptionalism seen in a very small way. And Tocqueville was the master at recording these sentiments. He says that Americans, when they think of solving a problem, they never think of running to the government. They
right.
just try to figure out, how do we collaborate with ourselves and make it happen?
Well, and that gets to Dennis's biggest point and one of his great lines: the bigger the government, the smaller the citizen. And the bigger the government, the smaller the church. And the bigger the government, the smaller the dream, Dinesh. Lee Habib with Dinesh D'Souza here for 3 hours. America, imagine the world without her. Go see this. Run to it. Race to it. See it tonight. See it this weekend. Go to the website. Again, Lee Habib sitting in for Dennis Prager. Give me fuel. Give me fire. Give me that which I desire. This is Lee Habib, sitting in for Dennis Prager here on July 4th. A little racing car theme music for a brief discussion about the life of Mario Andretti, whom I had always assumed was an Italian citizen. And this little piece in the Wall Street Journal to disabuse me of that notion. This guy won everything you could win in auto racing. Formula One, straight to stock car. Not a lot of guys had that crossover potential, but he did. Indeed, no driver from the United States has ever won an F1 race since Mario Andretti did. Except, of course, for what just happened over Memorial Day. And I'm not a big race fan, but this story will interest you even if you're not. Grandmothers in rural Kansas know Mario's name, but more importantly, so do grandmothers in rural Japan and Germany, said Sam Smith, executive editor of Road and Track, in this remarkable Wall Street Journal piece. How many athletes are on a first-name basis with the entire world? Well, it turns out Andretti rarely invites journalists into his home in Nazareth, Pennsylvania. That's where Mario calls home. Go figure. I would have figured it was like Como or something. He'd be living next to George Clooney and chasing supermodels. Actually, I think George is giving that up, because when you hit a certain age and you're chasing supermodels, it just looks ridiculous. In the sports bar built in the bottom floor of this home, this sprawling home in Nazareth, the 73-year-old former racing driver keeps a tribute to the town in Italy where he was born, Montano, which is part of Croatia today. The humble shrine could fit in a shoebox, and yet you could scour the nation and fail to find a more potent symbol of the American dream, writes A.J. Baim in the Wall Street Journal. It's my little shrine, Andretti said in an interview at the home this summer. It signifies why I'm in the United States, where I came from, and our plight as a family affected directly by World War II. From the drawings of Montano to the trophy cases upstairs, his house is as much an autobiography as a piece of architecture, the symbol of a boy who had everything taken and who spent his life trying to win it all back. A few feet from that Montano shrine is a heavy wooden door, behind which is a wine cellar. Andretti owns a winery in Napa, and the cellar in his home contains bottles older than he is. The grape signifies the beginning of his story. You see, before World War II, his father owned 2,100 acres in Italy. He was a grower of grapes, Andretti said. He was basically a farmer. Grapes were the big part of his life. At the end of the war, Yugoslavia occupied Montano, and a communist government took over. My father lost everything, Andretti said. His family was displaced to a refugee camp in Lucca. They lived there 7 years in one room. And this is where things started to get interesting. At a garage in Lucca, Mario and his twin brother Aldo learned to drive by parking cars. I could hardly reach the pedals, Andretti said. He was 12. We were buzzing wheels and doing burnouts, those poor customers. While living in Lucca, Andretti went to a 1954 Italian Grand Prix at Monza. My idol, Alberto Ascari, was driving for Ferrari. We were mesmerized. That's when the mold was cast, the dreams of a young child. It all seemed to happen that day. The family emigrated to the United States a year later, settling in Nazareth. As a teenager, he was working in a gas station when he and his brothers hatched the idea to build a race car from a Hudson Hornet. They borrowed $500 from a bank and got fake IDs. Now, if that ain't the American spirit, what is? And by the way, his father was completely against this, and so what did he do? Well, he does what boys always do. Disabuse their father's notions of what they should be and do what they wanted to do. Challenge the father's authority directly. We had no formal training, Mario said. It was the school of hard knocks. You dream what you're supposed to do, and you don't accept failure, because you can't afford it. Bob Dance, who later served as Andretti's chief mechanic, remembered seeing the racer as a rookie at the Indy 500 in 1965. He was this slim little kid from Pennsylvania. He was just a remarkable talent. Now, decades later, the trophy case in Andretti's home tells the rest of the story. He won the Daytona 500, the Indy 500, 12 hours at Sebring's, the IndyCar title, and any number of dirt tracks and sports car races. Andretti's F1 debut was with the Lotus team in 1968 at Grand Prix at Watkins Glen. And here's what his mechanic said. Before the race, Mario asked, "Do you want me to put the car on the pole?" said Dance, and he just did it. In his first damn race, he went on to win 12. F1 races. Now, when you think about people who'd be Formula One racers, you'd think sons of scions of wealth. How else could you possibly get into F1 racing? And here's Mario Andretti, who I would have assumed was born of great wealth to the Ferrari family or the Lamborghini family. And he's a kid who grew up with an Italian father in Nazareth who farmed for a living and didn't speak English. And that's the story of America. And by the way, the story of America is filled with stories like these. And for some reason, our media doesn't want to tell these stories.
You know, I think, Lee, even today in Europe, inherited wealth is better than earned wealth. Because inherited wealth is presumed to be innocent. If you've earned it, people think, well, you must have run over some people to get it.
Right.
That's the Obama mentality, by the way. Whereas in America, the success stories are so legion, we've stopped counting. You can't keep count. And in fact, in the same family, it is not uncommon to have one guy pumping gas and the other guy working in Oracle software. In other words, the same genes, the same gene pool, the same social upbringing, and yet you end up in completely different places in life.
No doubt. I do think that one of the things that's happening in our country is, and I don't know how our folks can address this, but as we deal with lots of social change, as we deal with more difficulties as it relates to social movement and mobility because of schools, particularly education, and particularly with poor people trapped in poor schools, there are, I think, tremendous opportunities, Dinesh, for conservatives to talk to folks about these stories and what's inhibiting them, who's holding back the little guy. I think in the end, they always seem to be the champions of little guy. We seem to be the champions of big business and titans of industry and billionaires. When we come back, possibly, and I think we've got about a minute and a half now, but give me a little bit of your thought on that, and then maybe cut it in the back of the hour. We'll cut a little bit more of this.
Absolutely. I think the strength of America is the kind of life that it provides to the ordinary man. In other words, the rich guy is going to do well in any society. In fact, I think people who have traveled abroad know that the very rich live better outside of America than in America. And the reason is simply that you enjoy the pleasure of genuine aristocracy. You truly are treated like a superior human being. Now, that's not available in America. Tocqueville notices social equality. Even Bill Gates has more money than you or I do, but we wouldn't kiss his feet.
That's right.
So that's the egalitarianism of America that limits the prerogative of wealth.
You bet. Lee Habib sitting in with Dinesh D'Souza. America, imagine the world without her. Check Megyn Kelly's special tonight on Fox, 9 o'clock. The debate with Bill Ayers is resuscitated, the final part, and just all kinds of good stuff you'll see in that hour. Again, Lee Habib sitting in for Dennis Prager on this day, July 4th. This is Lee Habib sitting in for Dennis Prager. You're listening to James Brown. By the way, I cannot wait to see the new James Brown picture. And by the way, if I could have had one job in my life, one of the great jobs of all time, it would have been to be James Brown's lyricist. Because my goodness, get on up. That's it. And you get a royalty check for the rest of your life for that. Oh, well, a guy can dream. I wanted to just read just a touch on Tocqueville. Dinesh had brought it up. I'm here with Dinesh D'Souza for the full 3 hours. AmericaTheMovie.com. Demand it if it's not in your neighborhood, but it should be. It's in, 1,100 theaters, Dinesh, something like that?
It is, and on that website, you can find out where it's playing close to you. By the way, if I can mention, I also have a book, the same title, America, Imagine a World Without Her. I'm actually currently in a race with Hillary Clinton. We're both about number 60 on the Amazon bestseller list, but I'm moving up, she's moving down.
Well, help Dinesh beat Hillary, please. If we could do anything today, that would be an accomplishment. Here's what Tocqueville said about religion in this remarkable book, which is so readable. Anyone who is interested and has the time, it's public domain. Pop it down on Amazon, and it's free. Here's what he says. He says, the philosophers of the 18th century explained in a very simple manner the gradual decay of religious faith. Religious zeal, they said, must necessarily fail the more generally liberty is established and knowledge diffused. Unfortunately, the facts by no means accord with their theory. There are certain populations in Europe whose unbelief is only equaled by their ignorance and debasement. While America, one of the freest and most enlightened nations in the world, there the people fulfill with fervor all of the outward duties of religion. On my arrival in the United States, the religious aspect of this country was the first thing that struck me and my attention. And the longer I stayed there, the more I perceived the great political consequences resulting from this new state of things. In France, I had almost the opposite experience. And I had almost always seen the spirit of religion and the spirit of freedom marching in opposite directions. But in America, I found they were intimately united and that they reigned in common over the country. Dinesh.
I mean, first of all, I'm just struck by the beauty and insight and the ability to compare cultural institutions. The crudity, for example, when I listen to Obama talk, is, in comparison with, say, Tocqueville, is just staggering, you know? And Obama's life, by the way, is an embodiment of American exceptionalism,
exactly.
Right? I mean, just think of this. If Obama had been born in Kenya, like his brother George, I mean, he'd probably be living in the hut right next to George in the Huruma slum of Nairobi.
Yep.
He's got, at some level, know that, but he's so embittered against America and he's absorbed so many of his father's perverse dreams that he continues to nourish this story of anti-Americanism. Or maybe it was drummed into him in some school in Hawaii by Frank Marshall Davis,
yep,
or some of the other people he hung around with. But in either event, it's Tocqueville is like a draft of fresh water. After listening to the kind of liberal propaganda to which we're all subjected to because we live in America and we can't escape our culture.
You bet. And in the movie, you'll meet Tocqueville. And by the way, you'll meet his his colorist and his fashion designer too, I think. a great film that it does so much for so many folks. The response we're getting here on the network is overwhelming. This is Lee Habib sitting in for Dennis Prager, and we'll be back in just a few. This is Lee Habib sitting in for Dennis Prager, joined for the hour with Dinesh D'Souza. America, imagine a world without her, is in 1,100 plus theaters around the country. And please, what better way to celebrate the 4th than to go see this movie? You're going to hear why in just a brief moment. You're listening to Madison Rising and their version, their sort of rocking version of the Star Spangled Banner. If you remember in the late 60s, in August of 1969, Jimi Hendrix did his version, a sort of an angry version, sort of what Born in the USA was for Springsteen, sort of an angry look at America and what America had done to this veteran. And Bruce, a great writer, but I think sometimes disturbed about his relationship with his own country, country that gave him so much property, intellectual property and every other kind. And this is sung by a band that loves the country. What a crazy idea that a band that could love the country could actually sing the national anthem. Dinesh, where did you find these guys? And did anyone, when you were doing this, how were some of your partners, how did your partners feel about, you know, using this as a way to close the film?
Well, actually, to be honest, we had a big fight about it on our film team because someone said, well, you know, the music critics are really going to tear this to pieces.
And I jingoistic. Thought, yeah, it's jingoistic.
It's that, you know, and it's that's like in Europe. Right. There's sort of this disdain for patriotism, particularly the more kind of overt and naked it is, the more people want to run away from it. Ugh. People don't like to fly the flag and so on.
Right.
And what I love about this song is it's the opposite. It's got tremendous animal spirits, and it's essentially an in-your-face celebration of America. And it's got a kind of a new vibe to it. I mean, I'm used to and I love the Star Spangled Banner that's sung at the Super Bowl or sung at various sporting events, the traditional version. So Madison Rising, when I heard the song, then I went and watched their video. And then I thought, you know what? I want to remake this video. And so what we did was we rented a barge. We floated it off the Hudson River with New York in the background and the Statue of Liberty. And we rented a boat. And then we shot them playing the song on the barge from the boat. And then we had them going through the turnstiles and in the subway and walking through Times Square and with a live audience around them. So you get this tremendous feeling of the song exploding through the streets of America and with the Statue of Liberty in the background. This is how we end the movie, and the whole audience is on its feet.
Yeah, I mean, all of New Hewitt had just he couldn't believe the audience's response to this. And just good to hear that some modern musicians can actually cover, and this is one heck of a cover song, and sort of do justice to the song as well. We're going to be talking a little bit, Dinesh, in the next two segments about some of the positive aspects and some of the walks back in history that you take. And one of the characters you focus on is Frederick Douglass. And Hillsdale College, by the way, one of the sponsors of this show, and during the summer, if you can, please take the great book series lectures by Dr. Arn and his remarkable staff at Hillsdale. When you walk into Dr. Arn's office at Hillsdale, by the way, the only picture hanging in the office is a picture of Frederick Douglass. And Douglass had given a rousing speech at Hillsdale, one that Larry, I think, can quote verbatim. He's so remarkable in that way. But tell us why, A, you chose Douglass. And you have a little something there that I think you want to share with the audience, and please do.
Well, what I have is actually something that's not in the movie. In the film, we show the trauma of Frederick Douglass, because Frederick Douglass began by giving a very famous 4th of July speech. And the 4th of July speech is a merciless castigation of America. He goes to the American slave, what is the 4th of July? And then he basically goes on to say it's a disgrace. It's an occasion of shame. You say that you believe in equality, but you allow slavery. So you've got this merciless slamming of America. And it's right in our movie, by the way. Then Douglass, over the years, he met Abraham Lincoln, whom he at one point had called the white man's president. He thought that Lincoln was only for the white man. And over time, Douglass came to realize that not only was Lincoln fundamentally a good man, but that he was a good man in a good country, and that America was a great club, and that really what Douglass wanted was not to break with America, but to be part of America. All he was asking for was full membership in the club. What I want to talk about today is what happened after slavery was ended, when essentially, at the beginning of Reconstruction, people came to Douglass and they asked him this question: what shall be done with the black man? And Douglass gave a speech that I think has forever caused him to be cast out of liberal historiography, because it's the kind of speech that no Republican could even give today. And I just want to read a couple of lines from it. He goes, "What shall be done with them? Our answer is, do nothing with them. Mind your own business and let them mind theirs. Your doing with them is their greatest misfortune. They have been undone by your doings, and all they now ask and all they have need of at your hands is to just let them alone." And he goes on to say, "If you see him plowing in the open field, leveling the forest, at work with a spade, a rake, a hoe, a pickaxe, a bill, let him alone. He has a right to work. If you see him on his way to school with spelling book, geography, arithmetic in his hands, let him alone. Don't pass laws to degrade him. If he has a ballot in his hand, is on his way to the ballot box to deposit his vote for the man whom he think will most justly and wisely administer the government, let him alone." And then he goes on saying this: "If men were born in need of crutches instead of having legs, the fact would be otherwise. We would then be in need of help. But our duty is done better not by hindering than by helping our fellow man." In other words, the best way to help them is just to let them help themselves. So this is a sort of rousing gospel that says that, look, the black man has, even through slavery, the virtues of hard work, the love of family. You can see the ways in which the former slaves worked to reunite their families that had been dissipated during slavery. And Douglass's point was, we have what it takes. Just give us freedom, and we will make ourselves into the Americans that we wanted to be.
I can imagine what this speech would have sounded like after witnessing the evisceration of the African American family as a result of the Great Society. I mean, this is a speech 100 so years thereabouts before that time.
It was W.E.B. Du Bois, the black sociologist you mentioned earlier, did a study of the black family about 1905, and he found at that time that the illegitimacy rate for blacks was 20%. Now, it was higher than the white rate, which was virtually zero. But interestingly, the black illegitimacy rate went from 20% to now almost 70% between the 1960s and today. So it is not slavery that destroyed the black family. It's liberalism.
No doubt. No doubt. And indeed, you know, one of the narratives, Dinesh, that I think you might find interesting, that, you know, we challenged the dean of the Columbia Journalism School, who had written a great book called The Promised Land. And it was a story about the African-American migration from the South to the North in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. Sharecropping was done. The industrial North beckoned. And these folks escaped segregation. But the story that we confronted him with was the modern story of African Americans escaping and fleeing liberalism and returning back to the South. In the last 15 years, more African Americans have returned from the North to the South than ever migrated from the South to the North. And we asked Nick Layman, "Nick, where's the sequel to The Promised Land?" He said he wasn't interested in that story.
Right. You're talking about Nick Layman?
You bet.
Oh, yeah, sure. We have in our film an African-American woman who was the first self-made millionaire in America, female millionaire in America. Most people have never heard of her. And there's a reason, because the fact that she was such a success story at overcoming the huge hardships of segregation doesn't fit the leftist narrative.
You bet.
The leftist narrative is victimization. And they want a white oppressor and they want a black victim. So a black success story says, wait a minute, you know, it spoils, if you will, the morality story. So you have to take out the little white out, if you will. And so ironically, African Americans have to pay a high price for playing the victim game.
Oh,
they've got to be complicit in the demeaning of their own history, the shrinking of their own success stories. Our film, in a way, is a challenge to this historiography. We've had African Americans who came to our New York screening and they were blown away by this. They were almost like out of their seats because they realized that they've been lied to consistently by the left as a price for, here's a little affirmative action, but as a price, we've got to strip your dignity from you.
Well, and here's the ruse, Dinesh. We've invested more in giving months of our education establishment over to African-American history. And yet, even despite this idea of letting African-Americans teach themselves about their own history, they strip themselves of their own history while teaching history. And that's the irony of ironies. We're again listening to Madison Rising, the great and rousing rendition of the Star-Spangled Banner at the end of the film. Please go out, see this movie. Go to the website at DennisPrager.com. Also, get the book. It's close in competition with Hillary Clinton. And what better thing to do than to beat Hillary while helping Dinesh at the same time? Lee Habib sitting in for Dennis Prager. We'll be
what
back in
difference
a few.
At this point does it make?
What is America to me? A name, a map, or a flag I see. A certain word, democracy. What is America to me?
This is Lee Habib sitting in with Dinesh D'Souza, who one of our really wonderful staffers, mother, just said, OMG, 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 he's my hero. You got three OMGs. OMGs. Dinesh, no, you're not even allowed to comment on that. Dinesh just read beautifully from Frederick Douglass, and I wanted to share the Atlantic Exposition speech from Booker T. Washington. He was at the time coming at African Americans, a very different theory than Du Bois, who at the time was thinking that the best way to approach things was to train up the talented 10th, send them to Harvard, and collectivize America.
You know, Du Bois' slogan was agitate, agitate, agitate. And Booker T.'s slogan was work, work, work. And in some senses, those two things epitomize the two rival strategies for a group at the bottom to come up. Now, interestingly, for 70 years, the civil rights strategy has been based on Du Bois, agitate, agitate, agitate.
You bet.
And maybe it was necessary at the time. But once you have equal rights under the law, the Brown versus Board of Education, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the Fair Housing Bill, then what? Then it's sort of like saying you have the right to compete in the Olympics, but you still have to know how to run.
Yep.
So today, it seems to me Booker T. Washington is relevant and Du Bois is obsolete.
You bet.
And ironically, the people who are following the Booker T. Washington advice are the non-white immigrants. They may never have heard of Booker T. Washington, but nevertheless, they recognize that sure, there's going to be racism in a big country, but there's plenty of room to navigate around it. And there are wide horizons of – and I'm not just talking about the Koreans or the West –
No, Ethiopians,
Nigerians. The Haitians, the West Indians, the black immigrants no less than the Orientals come to America, and they're able to use the Booker T. Washington formula to move out of the ghetto, move into middle-class neighborhoods, send their kids to Purdue and Rutgers and eventually MIT. And it's very tragic because they're claiming their share of the American dream, leaving behind African-Americans who have been here so much longer.
Oh, you bet. In fact, at Harvard, a couple of years ago, I read this in the New York Times, if you're an African-American from Africa, you're in a different category in terms of minority and affirmative action status than people who've been here multi-generations. And that is, the people who've been here multi-generations get favored over the immigrant because those African immigrants are doing so well. Just an interesting sidebar. But here's what Booker T. Washington said in this speech to the Atlantic Cotton States and International Exposition. He started with a metaphor. A ship lost at sea for many days suddenly sighted a friendly vessel. From the mast of the unfortunate vessel was seen a signal. Water, water, we die of thirst. The answer from the friendly vessel at once came back, cast down your bucket where you are. A second time the signal, water, send us water, went up from the distressed vessel and was answered, cast down your bucket where you are. A third and fourth signal for water was answered, cast down your bucket where you are. The captain of the distressed vessel, at last heeding the injunction, cast down his bucket, and it came up full of fresh, sparkling water from the mouth of the Amazon River. To those of my race who depend on bettering their condition in a foreign land or who underestimate the importance of cultivating friendly relations with the southern white man who is their next-door neighbor, I would say, cast down your bucket where you are. Cast it down. Make friends in every manly way of the people of all races by whom you are surrounded. An absolutely radical idea at the time.
Not only a radical idea, but in a sense, an idea that is grounded in realistic experience. Booker T. Washington recognized it was not easy to be living in the segregationist South. You know, here was Du Bois sitting in the Harvard Sociology Department and pontificating about, let's have a riot over here, let's have a demonstration over there. What Booker T. Washington said, ultimately, people will respect a black man who lives in a two-story house. And what he meant by that is that ultimately prejudice is defeated through achievement.
Yep.
That ultimately the rumors of inferiority will persist. No matter how much you explain, well, the reason blacks aren't doing so well is because they don't have good schools. And the reason they can't do this is because of that. Excuses, excuses, excuses. And we might even agree with them. But ultimately, there's no more decisive. Imagine if I were to say blacks can't fight. That would be stupid because you go time after time, you see heavyweight champions knocking everybody else
right.
silly.
Yep.
And so the prejudice can't withstand actual experience.
Yep.
And even today, I think the final decisive blow against racism will be struck when black achievement equals the achievement of everybody else.
No doubt. And, you know, it was interesting. I was trying to dig up a clip of Bill Cosby's remarkable speech in, I think it was 2005 or 6, before the NAACP, celebrating the 50th anniversary of Brown v. Board. And he just couldn't take it anymore, the lack of achievement. And he just threw it on African Americans themselves to say, what is happening in our families? 50% dropout rate. And he kept saying 50% dropout rate. And he kept talking about the past, back when these weren't the numbers, before the Great Society. And he was just, well, you know what kind of a book Michael Eric Dyson wrote, which is essentially charging that Bill Cosby was white. You spoke quite a bit with Michael Eric Dyson. We've got about 2 minutes left in this space. What would Michael Eric Dyson say about Booker T, and what would he say about Frederick Douglass, and what do you think he's teaching his kids over there at the University of Pennsylvania, one of our great Ivy League institutions?
Well, you know, after my interview with him, the two of us are going to be debating live on Sunday. We're going to be on This Week with George Stephanopoulos.
Great.
And so we're going to be crossing swords a little bit on the very issue of America. Dyson, you know, he's very eloquent, and I think what he argues is the theft thesis. He argues that, look, the wealth of America is based on theft, and so his focus is on giving it all back. His focus is not on development or achievement. He wouldn't say that he's against those things, but I think he would say that – I think his view is we're in possession, America is, of Nazi-stolen art treasures.
Right, right.
And even if you didn't steal them and your ancestors stole them, they still don't belong to you. They belong to someone else, and you have to give it back. Now, there is a moral thrust to that, and I take it seriously in the film.
Yep.
But at the end of the day, I think that gospel of – It is an extension of agitate, 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 and it is sidelining what is sometimes it is the case that even though you're not the cause of your own exploitation, you are in the best position to do something about it.
No doubt about it. 877-243-7776. If you've seen this movie, please call in now. Let America know what you saw. 877-243-7776. Lee Habib sitting in with Dinesh D'Souza. You can see Dinesh and Bill Ayers in a final installment of their remarkable debate. My goodness, Megyn Kelly has had a field day with this. Dinesh, you've been programming your show for the past week. Good job. That's at 9 o'clock tonight. We're also imploring you to beat Hillary by going out and buying Dinesh's book. They're neck and neck in Amazon, and my goodness, what better thing can you do than to drive Hillary's, self-hagiography? We can drive that out of the top, whatever, and put Dinesh above her. That would be great. And, of course, see the movie America, Imagine the World Without Her. Bring your family. Bring friends. Bring everyone you know. Bring liberals if you can. Bring extra money. And bring some handkerchiefs, from what I understand. It'll move you, this movie. And Dinesh, just great work. And we're back with him. And we're going to be back and tell the story of Louis Zamperini, the final of three Italian immigrant stories as well. This is Lee Habib sitting in for Dennis Prager. Dinesh D'Souza joins me for the full show. America, imagine a world without her. Playing in theaters everywhere. If it's not playing near you, demand the movie. Go to demandamerica.com and ask for the movie. Overwhelm, folks. Get it in your neighborhood. But if it is in your neighborhood, take your family, take your friends. Take strangers. What the heck? It's July 4th. Right now, I want to talk about Louis Zamperini. We had the honor of meeting him here in the studios. Did some interviews with him. Remarkable guy. Laura Hillenbrand captured his life, his story, in a remarkable book called Unbroken. She also wrote Seabiscuit. Laura Hillenbrand herself suffers from a viral neurological disease that allows her to only write a few hours a day. A broken lady, as she said herself to us. And so thus she liked covering the stories of broken things. Seabiscuit, the trainer of Seabiscuit, the jockey of Seabiscuit, three broken men brought together by love. And Louis Zamperini, a broken man, but in the end resuscitated by Billy Graham and the love of Christ. 70 years ago, the world was convinced that Louis Zamperini was dead. There had been no word of this track star and former Olympian since his World War II bomber crashed into the Pacific. The military told his parents he was dead, and an annual collegiate track competition actually named a race in his memory. But Zamperini was alive. After surviving 47 days in a life raft in shark-infested waters and enduring 2 years as a Japanese prisoner of war, Zamperini was liberated in time to attend the second running of the Invitational Mile that had been named in his memory. Mr. Zamperini, a war hero, Olympian, and the subject of a celebrated book, an upcoming movie on his story of survival, died of pneumonia this Wednesday. He was 97. Again, Laura Hillenbrand, author of the best-selling book, Unbroken, had this to say. His wasn't a sad story. It was a triumph. He left a lesson in the breadth of possibility for all of us and in forgiveness. Zamperini was born in Olean, New York, and moved to Torrance, California in the 1920s. The son of Italian immigrants, he spoke no English when his family moved to California. This made him a target for bullies. So his father did what a lot of fathers did back then. He taught him how to box and defend himself. Soon he was, quote, beating the tar out of every one of them, said Hillenbrand. But I was so good at it that I started relishing the idea of getting even too often. I actually became addicted to it. Young Louis had a knack for getting into trouble. Some say he was so fast that he actually stole beer from bootleggers. His older brother wanted to keep him out of trouble, so he got him involved in track. Soon he was setting records. Soon he was at USC, where his coach said the only runner who could beat him was Seabiscuit. He soon found himself very young in the 36 Olympics, actually training for what he hoped would be the 1940 Olympics in Japan. He roomed with Jesse Owens in the Berlin Olympics. Quite a story already, don't you think? But something happens as he's training for the Japanese Olympics. He enlists. The world is at war. The Olympics are canceled. Pretty soon he's in flight in 1943, heading to Japan to save some friends in the Air Force who had crashed. Slight problem. His rescue mission turned into, well, a real big accident. Suddenly he's commandeered in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, surrounded by sharks, 12 guys in the plane, only three survive, 47 days in a raft in the middle of the Pacific. And, well, that's enough for a life right there. At one point in this menacing story, there's one particular large great white shark that keeps circling around this raft. The shark's twice the size of the raft. For some reason, it knows life's on board and torments these guys for two full straight days. And when Zamperini describes those nights of being nudged by a great white, you just can't imagine. Well, I can't even sit and watch Jaws, so I can't imagine actually being in the actual raft. Well, after 5 weeks on his raft, McNamara, as he's called in this great story, the tail gunner, was starting to fade. And Bob Simon, back in 1998, did a remarkable piece of storytelling about Zamperini, and you get to hear some of Zamperini right here. We're going to be going right now, Sean, to Zamperini 5, and this is the man himself.
On the 33rd night of this odyssey, the tail gunner realized his journey was coming to an end.
And he just asked me the question toward evening. You think I'm going to die? That was it. You think I'm going to die? And I said, yes, I think you're going to die.
He did not see the next break of day. Zamperini gave the eulogy, and then Just after dawn, he and Phillips slipped McNamara overboard. Now there were two men in a raft, as far from salvation as they'd been the day they crashed. 5 weeks had passed.
We're going to come back with the rest of this story right after the break.
And I had to start again with just my children and my wife. I thank my lucky stars to be living here today, 'cause the flag still stands for freedom and they can't take that away. And I'm proud to be an American.
This is Lee Habib, sitting in for Dennis Prager, sitting with Dinesh D'Souza. AmericaTheMovie.com. Find out where the movie's playing. Go see it, please. Go to Fandango. But see the movie. Bring your family. No better way to celebrate July 4th. And here on July 4th, we're celebrating the life of Louis Zamperini. You just heard what was happening in that boat and him having to toss a mate over the board and into the shark-fested waters. Tough. So he hits a low point and finally gets to land, only the land is, well, it's islands held by the Japanese. So even when he sees land and he thinks that life is good, life just got worse. Here's Zamperini talking to Bob Simon.
When they first put us in a cell, I just looked down at my knees, the bones and the skin, and I just started crying. Now here I'm an athlete. I remember myself when I was, you know, powerful physical athlete, and now I'm just skin and bone and a skeleton, that's all. And that brought tears to my eyes.
The story goes on. He finds a tormentor in his midst, a guy named the Bird, who takes a liking to tormenting this very tough Italian guy who just won't break for him. And the Bird just keeps coming after Zamperini and comes after him and comes after him, but just can't break him, can't get him to confess, can't get him to say the things he wants to say. Hillenbrand chronicles all of this beautifully. Somehow Zamperini survives the Bird, and ultimately the war ends, and even though there was a hit out on all of the POWs by the powers that be at Japan, he survives, and Zamperini returns home. And we hear more from this story from, well, Zamperini himself.
Every night, the Bird came into my nightmares. No matter what other nightmares I had, he was always in my nightmares. And I was always strangling him with my hands around his throat. All I wanted was revenge. When I came home from the war, I thought, if I ever make any money, I'm going to go back to Japan, I'm going to look him up, and I'm going to finish him off.
He's going to finish him off. This is what he hoped to do. And ultimately, this anger ultimately consumed him. Alcoholism, a breakdown of his marriage, his family relations. As you can imagine, this kind of anger could eat a guy alive. And then something pretty remarkable happens. And in this next clip, well, his wife does what a wife can do. She takes him at the time to see a young preacher in Los Angeles named Billy Graham.
His wife urged him to go listen to a young preacher named Billy Graham. One sermon did the trick. Zamperini decided to serve the Lord. How? Go to Japan, spread the word, and face the ghosts.
I was mad because I was going back to Japan, yet I was thrilled because I was in God's will. So I had those two mixed feelings.
At Sugamo Prison, he confronted many of his old guards and confounded them with absolution.
The most important thing in my Christian life was to know that I not only forgave them verbally, but to see them face to face and tell them that I forgave them.
Pretty powerful stuff. Here's Louis describing his feelings after that remarkable scene.
This was extremely emotional for me to know that there were that kind of people here that would erect such a memorial to prisoners of war. When I think back to 1945, and when we left Nuetsu, it was such a horrible place in our minds, I couldn't look back. But when I leave here today, believe me, I will look back, and I will never forget.
What he was looking at, by the way, were all of these flowers put down around a POW memorial by the Japanese people themselves. It blew him away. Well, Jim Nantz, during these Olympics in Nagano, had a chance, this great CBS commentator, color commentator, to sit down with Louis Zamperini. And I pulled this from that CBS interview, Sean. Well, it's a clip from Jim Nantz. We don't have it, but Nantz sat down with Zamperini and asked him about everything that had happened. And Zamperini basically said, "Pain never bothered me," he told Nantz. "Destroying my dignity, that stuck with me." Zamperini could have plunged into a world of self-pity, folks. He chose life, and his faith helped him do that. He gave up skateboarding at the age of 81. He reluctantly gave up skiing at the age of 91. In May, he was made Grand Marshal of the 2015 Rose Bowl Parade in Pasadena. Always to the end, Zamperini was teaching all of us not only how to survive, he was teaching us how to live. Dinesh, a story like that, you know, you're talking about victims. You want to talk about a guy who could have easily gone off the edge, hated the world, and just asked for something back. Just your thoughts on this day. I think this is one of the great American stories, a story every kid should know, every adult should tell their kids. Just your thinking about that.
It's a very American story, and particularly when you talk about him, you know, as an older man, I'm reminded that even now, and as I think about India, when people get old, and old is considered about 55 to 60, they kind of stop living. They just check out of life. They figure, I'm old, I've sort of done what I'm going to do, and my job now is to basically stand and observe life go by. And my grandmother, literally for the last 25 years of her life, would sit in her balcony and just watch life go by. It never occurred to her to do anything more than that. Whereas in America, it's to me amazing to see people, you know, in their 70s, you know, first of all, they're pursue remarriage, they're still having kids, they're under they're climbing things, they're fixing things. It's kind of unnerving, to be honest with you.
It is.
But that's that. It is that vitality of, again, the immigrant spirit that built this country.
You bet. When we come back, we'll be with Dinesh talking more about America the Movie. 877-243-7776. 877-243-7776. If you've seen the movie, give us a call. Let us know what you think.
I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy. Yankee Doodle do or die. A real live nephew of my Uncle Sam, born on the 4th of July. I've got a Yankee Doodle sweetheart. She's my Yankee Doodle joy.
Lee Habib sitting in with Dinesh D'Souza. We're closing out the hour. America the Movie. Please go see it. Go to americathemovie.com or Fandango. It's opening in 1,100 theaters plus. Megyn Kelly tonight on Fox, the hour dedicated to Dinesh, Bill Ayers, and the movie. And the book, please go out and buy it. Beat Hillary. They're a neck and neck right now. An ugly image, actually.
I didn't mention that to be the defining image of the book.
It's really ugly.
It'll just be one of those little things to kind of have my car pass her on the highway. That'd be kind of nice, yeah. But that's not why I wrote the book.
No. In fact, I was going to say Dinesh and Hillary cheek to cheek.
Hillary's not a writer.
She's not a writer. No, she's not. Dinesh, we got just a couple of minutes more. Tell me and tell the audience, you know, what you're hoping for as a result of this movie. And what else you might have in your bag of tricks coming up?
Well, the purpose of the film is to have people really fall in love with America all over again. I think that there's a natural patriotism in the American breast, and it's been sort of soured and beaten down and propagandized against. And so people almost – the left has had us up against the wall. Now, the shaming of America, as I call it, has a political motive. And what's the political motive? The shakedown of America. So if somebody has you up against the wall, they can reach behind you and lift your wallet, and you're not going to put up too much resistance because they're going to convince you that you stole all that stuff.
Yep.
Once the shaming is undone, once you realize that all of these charges are rigged and are bogus, it's not going to work anymore. And so the film is sort of a disinfectant. It's a detoxifier. I told my daughter, who's just finished her freshman year in high school, I said, this is kind of a refutation of your four-year college education. So, you know, bring your kids because it'll blow their minds. And it'll right away it's going to create their antenna are going to go up every time their professor comes up with one of their usual stuff. What about this? Have you thought about that? Gee, weren't there actually 3,500 African-American slave owners in the South? And didn't they actually own more than 10,000 black slaves? And isn't it odd that that's not in my textbook?
Right.
Well, that doesn't fit the morality tale, I guess the professor's going to have to fess up and say.
Yep.
And then you realize that you're dealing with a rigged game. And then the movie makes you a very dangerous American. Because
no
suddenly you're walking around with a little Swiss Army knife of arguments and ideas, and you become a liberal nightmare.
Well, this is great. And, Dinesh, no one can do it better than you. I've been around a long time, watched a lot of guys, and actually have known you longer than I think either of us would care to admit. But from a liberal education straight through to the end of racism, I think your most important book by far, and no disrespect to the others. I almost think it's almost time for a remake of that book because I think it just hit it precisely the almost right time, but I think now is the right time. America the Movie, go see it, americathemovie.com. It'll change your life, I think, at least for the day and maybe longer. Lee Habib sitting in for Dennis Prager. Thank you, Sean, for sitting in, and God bless America. And enjoy the weekend, folks.